Been going there for eons. Used to, not anymore. Last time I fell down, I couldn't get up. My granddaughters were sitting there laughing.
Everyone for being here. We have a quorum, so we're going to go ahead and get started to make the best use of everyone's time. So the first order of business is the approval of minutes from the December 2nd meeting.
I move we accept them.
Second.
Is there any discussion, questions, edits? And Margot, did you second that?
I did.
Okay. And all in favor of approval minutes, say aye.
Aye.
And opposed? Okay.
Hey.
First call to the audience. Anyone from the audience wish to address the group?
I do.
Yes. Anyone else call to the audience? Okay. Oh, Suzanne.
Hi. Suzanne Schaefer, SunTran customer. Appreciate the driver's input all the time. I don't know how that could be incorporated. Some kind of discussion of those issues could be incorporated into the task force, whether it's by having a teamster on or some other method. But it would be interesting to have some back and forth on some of these issues in a public forum like this. Two things. Having complimented you all on the detailed and informative minutes the last time I was here, I was actually disappointed that they were much less detailed last time, and in particular there was an agenda item about the SunGo system, which I would have liked to see, but I was out of town, and there's really nothing helpful in the minutes about that. So if there were any documents of that If there are any documents presented at the last meeting, I'd love to know where to find them. Third thing, your agenda item regarding vacancies on the task force. I'm just curious, I don't want to put anybody on the spot here, but if, with all those vacancies, why is Mr. Kaywood still not a voting member? not to put anybody on the spot, but as a member of the bus riding public who has benefited probably in more ways than I can even know from his work, I would love to see that. Anyway, on that, thanks.
Thank you, Susan. Okay. Next agenda item, update on transit announcements. Margo.
I believe we're asked to ask staff to make a report on some of the questions that have been raised by the calls of the audience, just no discussion. I'm correct on that?
I think we can ask that it be agendized for a future minute, but I don't think we can respond to...
No, we can't respond, but I would just like to ask for a report for the next meeting.
For future, sure.
About this... Who ruled that there was that Teamsters could not be GTF members, and where that information came from, and also I would like a report from SunTran on these camera systems. What cameras are on the buses? How many of them are there? What direction are they pointing? And what is the goal of each of the cameras?
Right on. Is it appropriate or whatever for you to reiterate that thing about why the Teamsters can't be on here? I don't know.
I can just...
Stab at it.
Yeah, I mean, I can share that. I mean, so we haven't decided whether they can't be on here as a TTF member. That's not something we decided. What I decided in talking with Cedar Tucson staff and SunTran is that... because of the kind of there's a firewall of what union issues and things that the city can and can't direct SunTran to do based on labor issues and those kind of things, that the request was a few months ago to add a Teamster person as a non-voting advisory member, and I declined to do that because instead I felt call through the audience was a better venue for that to happen. Because my desire is not to muddy that line of we as a TTF can't tell city or SunTran to fix some labor issue. That's a labor contract issue between the union and SunTran and the city, and there's all kinds of legal mumbo jumbo that we don't know about. And so that's the part I don't want to get stuck in that mire. And so if there are issues like this, then I feel like call to the audience is an appropriate place to raise them, and then we can ask staff to address some of those things. But I want to be careful that we don't get into things that we don't really have any say in.
My point was to ask for a ruling from the city clerk's office as to whether a ward member or the city manager could appoint a GTF,
which is a different category
than appointing them as an advisory committee member.
So I
would like to hear from the city clerk's office whether that would be allowed, or the city attorney, or whoever makes that ruling.
I think that's fine.
Yeah, and then just because the city attorney says something, that doesn't mean that's the legal be all and end all.
There's other opinions,
and sure. I think we owe it to ourselves to
know the answer to
check
to
them
that.
Out. Yeah.
Okay, so we have a couple of follow-up items.
So, Mario, who would the Teamster be representing? The ward who appoints them?
Yeah.
Or would
mm-hmm.
they be representing the interests city. Of the Teamsters?
No, they would be
a
citizen medicine like any of us. I mean,
okay.
You know, do I only talk about the paratransit, even though I'm the one who has somebody who rides the paratransit?
Right.
No, I comment on everything. So
right.
It would just be that someone who is a Teamster or a driver would be appointed by the ward person or the man or the city manager or the mayor to take a role here, take a seat.
As a citizen.
As a citizen.
Not as a Teamster representative.
Right. That's right.
Okay.
Because it's, you know, we represent all kinds of things here.
Yeah. I will say that the city's attorney's office did not advise for a Teamster to be appointed to the task force. And I'll take it back to them. per your request, but it was taken to the clerk's office and the city attorney's office, and they reviewed the establishing resolutions and the mission of the task force and did not find that Teamster negotiations, the labor contract, all that would entail is within that purview. So,
okay, I think the other way to phrase it is, if a person who was appointed by a ward was also a Teamster or a bus driver, would that preclude them?
I get it.
From
yeah.
being a TTF
yeah.
member,
and that's
because
how I'll oppose it to them.
There
yeah.
are rules that they cannot be employees of the city, so you can't be an employee of the city and appointed to any board and commission.
True.
But these people are not employees of the city; they're employees of SunTran. So that's why I was looking at that differentiation.
I'll pose the question.
Thank you.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Next agenda item. So we have staff updates. City of Tucson.
So it's Suzanne, just touching on your comment about Gene. Gene is an excellent candidate. I agree with you. And I'm putting together a list for Diana of candidates. Gene was a member.
Yes.
And Chair. I guess that was during a time when there were term limits. But I went back and looked at the resolution, and there are no term limits for TTF members, so I'm not sure why he was removed. But he is going to be on the list of recommended candidates that I present to Diana. Okay, just want to throw that out there.
If we have more, should we call you up?
Well, that's actually, it's on, sure, you can, but it's that's item 6, so we can talk about it. It's on the agenda.
Why are you talking? Clarify that for me, because for years it's been an 8-year term limit for people on all, not just this committee or task force or board, but on all of them.
Well,
to my knowledge.
No, well, this isn't a formal committee. It's a task here that's a task force that's renewed yearly or biennially.
Oh, so may be right, because like on the Downtown Links task force, that was working for 15 years or something, and we all got renewed.
Right, oh, so yeah. so you've been working in 12-month terms or 24-month terms.
Right.
And actually the task force is set to expire in June.
And again.
Again, so we'll see what mayor and council end up doing. Anyway, regarding the SunGo system, we were directed by Diana to form a focus group to discuss the future of the SunGo system, options for either changing the system, updating the system, bettering the system somehow, and I posed that, I queried the group at the last meeting. I did not receive any responses from anyone, any interest within the TTF. We are still going to move ahead with that, but yeah.
Oh, well, do you need volunteers?
Yeah.
I never heard anything about it.
Were you at the last meeting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We talked about
it. I didn't
know. One thing I would like to do, so I'd spoken to Suzanne about serving on that task force as well.
Okay.
Suzanne, are you still willing to do that? So I'd like to appoint her as a non-voting advisory member to be on that subcommittee, focus group, whatever they're calling it.
Why non-voting?
Because I can't, because that has to come from a ward or city manager. Somebody else has to, she has to be a full voting
okay.
member. Somebody has to go through that. She can do that, but this was just to be on that focus group. And so it was kind of a shortcut to get her onto that.
I need a clarification. Focus groups, as I understand them as a technicality, are groups which are put together usually from the outside of a sphere to discuss a specific topic. I gather from what you're saying, you're expecting to have a, quote, subcommittee of this task force to deal with the SunGo card. Is that what you're talking about?
That's incorrect. It's going to be a focus group.
Who's going to be on it?
We don't know yet.
How many people is it going to have?
We're not sure.
So how can you ask people? How can you ask people to join something?
I was gauging the interest of the committee members, saying, we presented on the SunGo system. Diana said, let's look into forming a focus group And so preemptively, I queried the group and said, would any of you potentially be interested in serving on this focus group? One or two of you. That's how it was presented.
Boy, it sure went past me.
Yeah, me too.
I'm a little unfamiliar with focus groups and what they do. What would be the efficacy of a focus group? Because from my usage of the Sungo system, it seems like it's a programming problems, like how things are updating. Because my recent experience trying to just add money to my card, it took the system like 24 hours to update, so I couldn't use it right away when I was trying to write it downtown on the Sunlink. Mm-hmm. So that my experience with the whole thing has been, it's just the way that things are kind of programmed and like in like a back end sort of thing are like not great. So what is a focus group supposed to do? Like, what can they do?
They're going to do it's TBD, but they're going to do a deep dive into the functionality of the Sungo system currently. Mm-hmm. What are its limitations? What are the problems that mm-hmm. we've had with it? What would be the cost of replacing it? What would be a cost of replacing it in phases? Can mm-hmm. you do that? What are some of the alternatives? All sorts of different
things. Doesn't SunTran already have a good idea of some of the dysfunctionality of it already from like customers complaining about things?
So typically, I think if you form a focus group, it's a group of people that have experience or somehow experienced whatever your product is, and you're asking them to give you information about what they like about it, what they don't like, what works, exactly. what doesn't work. You then, and you might do two or three focus groups. You could do one of users, you could do one of people that manage them, people at SunTran work with them, that could include staff, operators, maintenance, and everybody to get. So you get, but it's more of an input. You gather that information, and then from that information, you start to decide, what do we want to do as next steps in terms of taking a look at how this thing works? So.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
Too. Yeah, so when Chris was talking focus group last month, what I understood it was they're going to try to get a group of people that have some kind of experience with Sungo products in a room to share their thoughts, their concerns, what works, what doesn't work, so that we can start trying to formulate what are ways to make the product better.
Or part of that discussion was, what else is out there? What are some options?
Yeah. Now that might go beyond the traditional definition of a focus group, which is information gathering. Then you might form a task force that starts to get into the detail. I think maybe that's where the
Brian, what did you have?
Yeah, Missy Ingram would volunteer to be on it, right, from the Teamsters. And since it's just a focus group, I don't think we have to deal with the city manager looking down on us on that type of thing. So is that right, Missy?
Yeah,
Missy Ingram.
Makes sense. Yeah, as an operator, your experience.
Bus driver.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. 22 years.
Very interesting. That would be very important.
That's it.
Will you be trying to recruit riders? Just your average rider?
Probably. Obviously, I don't have many answers at this point. It was just, testing the waters, so to speak, to see if people might be interested. Mm-hmm. So
okay,
we'll have to flesh out the details later. I haven't had a chance to sit down with Diana. It was like, let's look at forming a focus group. Okay. I didn't receive any more direction than that. So at the next meeting, I'll try to have some more information for you. That work?
So we've got a few names that are interesting.
Yeah, I got them down. I got Suzanne, Misty, Eric. Eric. Okay.
Is a focus group like they meet over an extended period of time, or is it like a one-time thing that they go through the... I'm just curious.
I'll get back to you.
Yet.
I don't know. You can Google it. Okay.
Normally it's a one-shot time. Yep. If it's more than that, it becomes a subcommittee. And there's nothing wrong with subcommittees, and we can appoint them. We did the strategic plan subcommittee, mm-hmm. and that worked really well. We worked almost 2 years. We thought it was going to be 6 weeks. We put on people who are regular members and people who are advisory committee members. So I would encourage you to make it a subcommittee if you are really going to also then investigate alternatives and what kind of options you think the group would recommend back to us.
And I would add to that that if you form a subcommittee, one way of getting input is to have focus groups.
That's right.
And the focus groups would be, you know, you might have a focus group that is simply SunTran employees that give you their input. You might have another focus group that's simply users. And then they give information that'll help the subcommittee be more informed on issues as they move forward.
That's a good way to look at it.
Okay.
Okay. FTA grant?
Yeah, the FTA grant, not much here. we are hoping to hear back in January, but I reached out to the program manager. He said it's likely going to be February before awards are announced. I recall sharing with the group that Mayor Romero flew to Washington and met with the acting FTA administrator and discussed this grant, the streetcar, and some other things, and the meeting went well, so we'll have to see. And Suzanne, just a heads up, we are going to talk about the minutes under agenda item. Was it 5, 6? I'll bring that up. Okay. That's all I have.
Any SunTran? Any other updates? Any other stakeholder groups? Anything? Okay. Next item. Then we have the GPLAT presentation.
Well, good afternoon.
Hello.
My name is Kevin Burke. I'm the Deputy Director of the City's Office of Economic Initiatives. I'm here with my colleague, Mike Chikowski. He's the Economic Initiatives Project Manager. And I want to take a few minutes today, not 30, although if you have questions, we obviously can go along. I've just got a couple of slides to go over the city's GPLAT program. So first, just by way of background about the Office of Economic Initiatives, we are part of the City Manager's Office. We're actually a very small team. We're a task force of 3 within the City Manager's Office with responsibility for, we'll just say, all things economic development. But in general, what we like to say is we build connections throughout the community and we try to facilitate all types of both public and private development. We're focused on downtown, but we work citywide. So let me show you a couple of examples of what we mean by partnerships. We'll refer to this as the economic development ecosystem in Tucson. This is not by any means inclusive of all of the organizations or folks, partners, you know, groups that we work with, but this is a representative sample. So the University of Arizona in all different ways, shapes, and forms. Groups like Startup Tucson you may have heard of that are focused on fostering the entrepreneurial ecosystem in Tucson. The airport, Pima Community College, other educational providers, groups like Rio Nuevo, Sun Corridor, who also performs an economic development function but is somewhat distinct. It's obviously a private organization, a public-private organization. Their focus being on marketing and attracting new companies to the region. So that is one thing that the City of Tucson, our office, is also interested in. We partner on those efforts. The city is also interested in existing businesses, so how do we retain and help existing businesses expand? That's it. A snapshot of our economic development ecosystem. Some of the programs that we have already financial incentives. So I'll highlight just 3 of the primary programs that we use. Primary jobs incentive is one of the major programs that we use. This is for major employers, those people who are what we refer to as primary employers. So what we can provide for these larger projects, if they qualify, that means they're making a capital investment of at least $5 million, and they're creating at least 25 jobs that pay higher than the area median income, and that's the number you see here. They must pay at least $54,923, and they have to provide health insurance. So if a company meets those qualifications, what we can do is provide them a credit equal to a portion of the construction sales taxes involved in their project. They can use that for things like construction of public infrastructure or for job training programs. Another one, which we'll talk about in more detail, is government property lease excise tax. So primarily focused in the Central Business District, that is to say downtown. A couple of qualifications to be able to use the GPLET tool is you have to be making improvements in your property that will increase the value of that property by at least 100%. That is to say, if your property is on the tax rolls for $1 million, when you're done with the project, that property needs to be on the tax rolls for at least $2 million, otherwise you don't qualify. We can participate using the GPLET tool by abating a portion of the property tax for the project, but the amount that is rebated back to the private owner, to the developer, can't exceed the public benefit, that is the benefit to the city and other taxing jurisdictions. I'll get more into that in just a few minutes. The other one I wanted to mention is the site-specific sales tax incentive. We don't use this incentive too often, but it is for, as a targeted incentive for large sales tax generators. As I think you all may be aware, the city of Tucson is highly reliant on sales tax dollars, and so this is a tool that we have to help facilitate some of that sales tax generation within the city. I'll highlight just a few recent wins. We've been very busy, not just in the last year, but over the past few years. Downtown Tucson in particular, but the region as a whole has continued to experience really strong growth. Our office has played a part in that. So a couple projects to highlight. What is the old Hotel Tucson across the street from City Hall? HSL Properties owns that. We have entered into an agreement with them using the GPLET tool as well as the site-specific sales tax tool to make a major reinvestment back into that property, and it'll be rebranded as a Hyatt Hotel. We hope to see construction starting on that project in the next few months. Modular Mining is an existing business here in Tucson. Mike, who are there? Almost 300 employees there?
Mm-hmm.
And so we did an agreement with them, a primary jobs incentive, for them to add an additional 35 jobs in this last calendar year. Texas Instruments, a similar type of story. Texas Instruments has been a major employer here in Tucson for decades. They're expanding. They're actually building a new corporate campus at the Williams Center in Midtown. And so the city is participating in that through the primary jobs incentive, giving them some credit for a portion of the construction sales tax associated with their project, and allowing them to contribute to job training programs and the provision of public infrastructure associated with that work. A couple of other notable projects, Amazon, you know, many people have heard of that. The city, the county, Sun Corridor, essentially all of our regional partners have been working on a long-term basis with Raytheon to help them continue to expand and to keep those important primary jobs located here in our community. Hexagon Mining, another headline project, which you have seen in their new building downtown. And then another one that I want to point out is Northwest Healthcare. We did a deal with them earlier this year, again using the primary jobs incentive. They're going to be constructing a brand new full-service hospital on the Far East Side, which if anybody, you know, has been on the East Side or from the East Side like I am, you know there's been a distinct lack of true healthcare facilities out there. So a new hotel will be under construction. I said hotel. A new hospital will be under construction this year at Houghton and Old Spanish Trail, right? Huge project that we're really excited about, like 500 plus jobs that they'll be creating out there.
Hey, which one of those are GPLETs then? The HSL, Hyatt, and?
Of these, well, of those pictured, just the HSL. And actually, let's go ahead and.
What about other notable projects? Is there any in there? Amazon?
No. No, none of those. Only HSL on that list. So we've got a couple of things we'll hand around. The first is a map and a spreadsheet that show all of the GPLET projects.
Thank you.
Great, so two documents there, one is the map and one is the spreadsheet. Those are correlated. The only exception is that the spreadsheet goes 1 through 25. The map has not been as recently updated. It goes, I think, through 23. So the two most recent projects have been shown on the map. Let me take a step back before we dive into that detailed information, just to go over the GPLET, what it is in general. So GPLET stands for Government Property Lease Excise Tax. We refer to it as an economic development tool, and what it allows the city to do is to take ownership of private property and then enter into an agreement with the previous private owner to lease that property back. Okay? So the city becomes the owner of the property, and what happens with government-owned properties? It's not taxed, right? And so that, in essence, is the economic development incentive. When the city takes ownership of the property, per state statute, for a period of up to 8 years, the city has the ability to abate those property taxes on that property. We do that to calculate, essentially, to provide gap financing. So the idea is that for projects that would not otherwise occur, right? Not all real estate development pencils out the first time around, and sometimes with a little bit of incentive, projects that the city finds an economic benefit in, we help facilitate those projects moving forward, and that's what we use the GPLUT tool for. So I just want to be really clear about one thing. The use of the GPLUT tool is at the absolute discretion of the city council. It is not a by right incentive. It is not an entitlement for any private property developers. If you're within the Central Business District and if you meet the other requirements that I mentioned, that you're increasing the value of the property by more than 100% and that the benefits outweigh the cost to the city, we'll take those projects forward for council consideration. I mentioned the independent economic analysis. So what we do when we receive an application, when we have a party who's interested in using the GPLUT tool, is we have them submit detailed information about their proposed project. We give that information to a third party that we contract with to perform this assessment. So it's not city staff running the numbers, right? We have qualified professionals outside of the organization who are objective third parties, run that economic impact analysis. They tell us whether the costs exceed the benefits, right? Or I should say the other way around, right? Whether or not the benefits exceed the costs, whether or not they would recommend for the city to enter into one of these agreements.
Who does that, the state, or do you have a private company?
That is correct, yes.
What's the name of it?
Applied Economics. So it's a company out of Phoenix. It's essentially a team of economists who are skilled in running those detailed financial analyses. Did I get that right? Yeah.
And how do you, so they say whatever they say, and then how do you track that and make sure that the GPLETs are panning out according to, what's that thing called, applied economics?
Yeah, their financial impact analysis. So
accountability.
Right.
How does that work?
That's a good question. So it's not covered in here. So let me just sort of explain the time frame of how these GPLUT projects work, right? The first step is someone comes to us and says, this is the project that I want to do, right? That second step then is we collect all of their information and we conduct the fiscal impact analysis. We take that information back to the city council, and if the city council at their discretion decides it's a project that they want to enter into, then we'll finalize those agreements. And so what you see before council is usually the last step in that project. They're going to say, we have executed this agreement and this lease. So we will take ownership of this property for some defined period of time, right? Provided that all of these requirements are met. Just one second, and then I'll be happy to answer the question. That lease does not actually take effect at the date of council approval. That lease doesn't take effect until those improvements are made in accordance with what the developer said they were going to do. So the city doesn't immediately take ownership of the property. They have to first do the project and demonstrate that they've met what they said they were going to do. So when we run the analysis, just as like a random example, right? We're going to invest $5 million in this hotel project, right? And the fiscal impact analysis takes that into account. So then they have to actually do the project. And if they've invested the $5 million and the project is what we assumed it would be, what we planned for it to be, then the lease agreement goes into effect. The city takes ownership of the property and the project effectively starts at that date.
So, would that be before the hotel, for instance, opens?
Yeah, absolutely. So to your point about accountability.
Yeah, like after a year,
if
2 years, 3 years.
A developer said, we're going to do X, Y, and Z improvements, and we enter into an agreement with them. If they don't do those improvements, there's no actual lease in place. We don't actually take possession of that property. There's no incentive to them because they've not performed. And there was another question.
Yeah, I recall from looking at a number of agendas and listening to council meetings that there are actually two votes. So the first vote is where you authorize to do the economic impact analysis. And then the other vote is later when it comes back, then you authorize them to.
That's right. We actually take the GPLETs to council
three times. Okay.
So I don't think bore everyone to death with our arcane processes. We take the project to council prospectively and say, this is the proposed project. Are you interested at all?
Right.
And then say, yes, we're interested. And then we do the fiscal impact analysis. we take that back to them. If they say, okay, we're still interested, then we come back a third time with the final agreements, which they'll approve. Thank you for that clarifying question. All right, let's see where we're at here. Almost done.
Have you ever seen one of those on the agenda?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
But the first step?
Mm-hmm, the first step, yeah.
So I mentioned that the GFLAD, again, is at the discretion of the city council, right? We'll take projects four that we believe are in the public interest, that we believe meet all of the tests, and that are going to be to the financial benefit of the city and to the community over the long term. The city council has a responsibility for deciding yes or no on those projects. We believe that the GFLAD tool has been instrumental in the revitalization of, broadly speaking, the Central Business District, but specifically downtown. And as you'll see on the map, the majority of the projects that we've done under GPLET in the past couple of years are highly focused in the core of downtown. We have seen, as a result of GPLET projects, over $370 million in private investment, right? In private investment that will, over the course of the 8-year life of each of those projects, result in new tax revenue of in excess of $125 million. So that's what we say when we mean that we believe it's of benefit to the community.
So can you clarify kind of the timeline? I thought in that 8 years that you're not collecting that tax and that payoff was more over long, like a longer term period, or how does that work?
So the benefit numbers that we're calculating are within that 8-year project cycle. And then, yeah, it's even higher after the 8-year period when the city transfers ownership of those properties back to the private owner and they're back on the tax roll. We continue to accrue an economic development or an economic benefit. That's not what's included in the fiscal impact
analysis. It's just when you're giving them a tax break, you're just talking.
Correct.
I think one other point, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it isn't just the city property tax that gets abated. It's the county, it's the library, it's the flood control district, it's the school district, it's all that list that you see on your property tax.
All taxing jurisdictions.
All taxing jurisdictions. And so they're on faith betting that at the end it's going to be better than it was at the beginning.
Yeah, which just in general terms, if you think about it from the state legislature's perspective, who authorized this and allows the city essentially to enter into agreements that abate taxes for other jurisdictions, mm-hmm. right? And we notify all those jurisdictions every time we have a project. It's a part of the statutory process. But kind of think about why they would think that's okay. Well, they put in this test that says you have to increase the value of the property by more than 100%. And that's essentially the thinking, is that on the back end, at the end of this 8-year or whatever that term is, that we're considering abating the property taxes, those taxing jurisdictions are still going to see an increased benefit because of the improvements to the property over time.
But how do you do that with only 3 employees? Figure out if the thing's panning out over the 8 years.
They work lots of hours.
Well, we're not tracking those projects on a daily basis. So again, we don't actually enter into the lease agreement. We don't take physical possession of that property until those improvements are done. Right. So really, it's a one point in time when we have to understand whether or not the project is performing. Right. Right now, just think about the hotel Tucson on downtown, the HSL property. Nothing's happened on that property yet. The council entered into that agreement in September, right? September? November? The date is on your spreadsheet here. The council entered into that agreement, but nothing has actually occurred. They have not made any capital investment in the property, and as a result, the city's not taking ownership. The decision point comes in another year or 18 months, whatever that construction period is, when we'll check their numbers. We're going to check their work. Have you performed the way that we expected you to perform, right? And if they've met that goal, then we'll execute that lease agreement and we'll take possession of the property.
Do we have any properties that have gone the full 8 years and that we have given them back and have the projections proved accurate?
So not yet. And if you look at the spreadsheet, actually I think we don't show, I just think it's copied over. If you look at the council, so fourth column, I think from the right, council mm-hmm. approval date,
yeah.
right? And so the council didn't authorize the use of the GPLET tool until 2012. So all of the GPLET projects in the form that we're talking about, right, where the city takes ownership and abates property taxes for 8 years, have happened since 2012. So none of those projects are yet complete, if that answers your question.
That's, yeah. So we don't know, we're still working on faith of economic projection models?
Well, no, we know that the projects were constructed per what we agreed to, right?
Right, but we haven't been guaranteed that the taxes are going to be what we thought they would be.
When the properties are transferred back to private ownership,
right,
and the county assessor comes in, usually, I mean, we all know, like, this yep. takes a while, so a year or so lag, then yes, we'll have a final step of verification that the projects are continuing to perform. That's correct. So that's all I have in terms of an overview. This is the most comprehensive and detailed information that we have compiled on the GSLEP program. We provided this to the Internal Audit Committee just about a month ago, and so you have it in your hands as well. Mike and I are happy to answer any other questions that you have. This is our contact information.
Just a couple of clarifying questions for this info. So the columnist is value of GPLAT incentive. How is that different from the revenue impact? Or can you, where does that number come from?
So if you look at the column that says total revenue impact, and that's to all taxing jurisdictions, mm-hmm. that is the amount of taxes and direct and indirect expenditure that the city, the county, right, all of the taxing jurisdictions expect to receive over this 8-year period,
okay.
right? The value of the GPLAT incentive is the other side of the coin, right? It's the expected benefit to that private developer over the same year.
That's kind of their savings as the incentive to use it.
That's the incentive, yes.
Okay. And then one other question is that the final column, the post-GPLAT property value is often, I think for almost all of these, is less than the project capital investment. So like they invested $26 million and the property value at the end is only $18 million. So where's...
So the asterisk on that is basically how property assessment works okay. in Arizona. Right? You can have a capital investment of X. It doesn't transfer dollar for dollar okay. to the assessed value, just the same as, your house, right?
Yeah.
So that's why we're tracking the pre-GPLAT property value per the assessor, and then we will, to the point we just discussed, track the post-GPLAT assessed valuation as well.
How do we as the public figure out what GPLAT you're gonna do that first stage on? Because to find out about it on the council agenda when they're gonna, I don't want to use the rubber stamp, when they're gonna pass it ultimately.
Yes.
Because have they ever turned down one in the last years?
Not
I don't think
knowledge.
They. Yeah, I don't either.
We right.
So we. How does the public find out in the very first? Stage of it, because you talked about the three stages. Mm-hmm. Well, how does the public find that out?
The same that essentially you would find out about any item going forward yeah. for council consideration. So the very first time when we take a proposed GPLAT project forward, it's going to be in council study session. And just like every other item, in study session, we're publishing that agenda well in advance, right? And everyone has...
Yeah, I don't find that they get
Friday
published well
to
in
Tuesday,
advance.
Or if it's yeah. a late edition, Monday night at 10 o'clock.
Right.
Per state statute, right, we're notifying the public of the meetings coming up and those agenda items.
Is that usually on, what do they call that thing where that one part of the agenda where they don't really talk about a consent agenda?
We'll always take these items forward for the first time
yeah.
in study sessions.
Yeah.
Right, so the earlier afternoon meetings. The second time we take it forward,
we do it in a
study session again.
Okay.
And then the final approval, sometimes, and this is essentially at the mayor and city manager's discretion, sometimes those will go on the consent agenda. Sometimes they'll be on the regular agenda
okay.
for discussion.
Okay. So I have a question, and this is especially relevant, I hope, I think, in regards to the fact that we have a new mayor that, in my estimation, is more pro-environment and pro-transit. And I'm optimistic about the new mayor and council, and that they're going to be more pro-bus. And so, the real question that I think concerns this group here is how does the GPLAT figure into more ridership on transit,
yeah,
making our transit
access.
System, and shouldn't some of these hotels be how do you do it? How do you say it? Incentivized to do bus passes for all their patrons, all their customers. Like if you're going to give a GPLAT to all kinds of different entities, they need to be be coughing up bus passes to, you know, increase ridership, no?
So Diane has some input.
Oh, great, great.
Hi, everybody.
Hi. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to everybody. Diane Alarcon with Transportation. It's kind of hard to put that in the responsibility of GPLAT. What we need to do is actually create a transportation demand management system. And in that, that's where you put the incentives in.
That a what?
A transportation demand management system. So what the, a TDM. So what that does is that looks at your transportation and focuses on your transit. And that's where you can come up with your incentives, such as bus passes, that would play into the GPLAT, into some of your zoning, into some of your other planning initiatives that would encourage them, like, to look at creating more of a transit-oriented development kind of building that would encourage the buses versus a car. Okay, so we actually are in the process of hiring someone who has strong TDM experience so that we can create a TDM for the city of Tucson. Because our size, and as we're moving forward with our transportation initiatives, we should have a TDM program in place that offers these types of incentives for development, for also for businesses, as well as also for local government.
Hell yeah.
And so we're working on that. So yes, we recognize it's something that we're a little bit short right now, but we are moving in that direction.
I assume that's part of what, like that TOD grant, some of the toolbox that would
develop. Well, the TOD grant will help feed into the TDM, but it would not be the end all be all. So we actually need to
a broader
perspective and look at it from all angles of it. It all together. So a transportation demand management system looks at your zoning. It also looks at your parking. It looks at your incentives. It
really?
Looks at your carpooling, your vanpooling, all of those great programs that we really should be pulling together. So
that's part of where this initial discussion was. Some of the incentives that were being handed out were, you know, like 600 parking spaces and, you know, there's a lot of incentivizing of free parking.
Right.
Yeah,
and that's where the TEOD study, if we're successful in getting that grant from the federal government, is going to give us some really good toolboxes that will actually feed into the TDM as well, but it won't be the only thing, because there are five elements that are pulled into a TDM system.
Can you do a timeline on how you think that might go?
Got to get the person hired first, and then I'll be glad to put a timeline together for you.
Are you optimistic?
I'm optimistic, yes. So it's actually, the position just became vacant, so we're getting ready to advertise for it.
Oh.
And I'm hoping I'll bring someone in that's got a lot of that talent already under the belt.
Super.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I would just say, to that point, you know, if you take a look at the map of all of the GPLAT projects, these are essentially all transit-oriented developments, right? They are on transit lines, they're on the streetcar line, they're predominantly focused downtown. The City Council has provided direction to our team to take a look at our GPLAT policy and to bring back some revisions. And so we're in the process of doing that right now. Not something that I would share in any great detail, since the council hasn't heard anything about it yet, but the idea being, what are the additional community benefits that we can ask for, right? What else can these developers provide to the community in exchange for those often substantial incentives that they're getting using the GPLAT tool?
And one of the things, so you talked about that one of the requirements is that the speed for a project that wouldn't happen otherwise, but for the GPLAT, and so Are there kind of standards or tools to kind of, when do we get to a point where these developments feel like, you know, downtown has this momentum, things are happening,
yeah,
and stuff would be built regardless, and so we're not just giving incentives to things that would be built anyway. Kind of where how do we decide that?
Yeah, you're on the same page as the City Council, right?
Okay. That's exactly
some of the conversation that we've had in study session the last couple of projects that we've taken forward. And that's not going to be, you know, a question for staff to answer, because it is essentially a policy decision, right? It's at the council's discretion when they want to use this tool and at what scale. And I will say this, we have essentially taken a blanket approach with the GPLAT. Statutorily, you can do up to 8-year periods for 100% abatement of that property tax. It doesn't mean you have to do 8 years, and it doesn't mean you have to do 100%, right? And so when we talk about projects meeting the but-for test, which, you know, in the economic development world, that's the test that we're trying to hit with any type of project. Right? We don't want just to be incentivizing projects that are going to happen anyways, right? We want to make sure that our impact is really being felt and making projects happen that wouldn't otherwise. And so if we can, say, look at a project in greater detail and say, the gap on this project is only X, right? Let's tailor our Gplot incentive to meet that X, to fill that gap and make sure the project happens and not necessarily go to Y, right, and go above that, if it's not necessary for the project to happen.
And then slightly related, but maybe, so how does this, so the map that we have, or is this only applicable within the, what is it, the CBD? Is that the district?
The abatement, so, and this is where Gplot gets like a little bit complicated, but for, in simple terms, the 8-year abatement is only available inside the central business district, which is the boundary you see on the map. The Gplot tool also provides for the city to take ownership of essentially any private property and lease it back to those owners at a rate, a rental lease rate that is defined in statute, right? Okay. And that's the other piece of the Gplot tool. If you look at the first two projects on that list, those are sort of the well, I'll just say old school type of Gplot that are really lease only agreements, and we have not entered into any of those in a number of years.
Okay.
So mostly what we're talking about is inside the boundaries of the CBD.
And that's, there's some discussion about changing or expanding these boundaries or doing something.
So the way that I would frame the discussion is the CBD per statute expires after X number of years, and so it has to be recertified, right? The CBD is allowed to be up to 2.5% of the city's total area. Right, and so when we recertify, what we want to do is take a look at the CBD boundary and first of all see, is it where we need it to be, and are we maximizing it to the extent that we can or want to, right? And so that's the process that we're going through right now.
So that may change. In
yeah, I think the boundaries, I'll say the boundaries are certainly going to change, mm-hmm. but it's kind of tinkering around the edges, yeah. right? It's not like
dramatic,
wholesale.
Yeah.
We're not moving the central business district to the Williams Center.
Yeah.
Right?
So what happened 6 months ago or whatever at the council when they said, did they say we're only considering enlarging the CBD, or did they actually do it?
They did not do it, no, because that's the recertification process. So there has been a discussion at council, and I couldn't tell you exactly when, because I think it was a little bit before I started with city, about a year ago.
Yeah, actually, I think it was right after Kevin started.
Okay, so
we had a conversation in the summer.
Yeah,
we had a conversation with council, and we've got about 25 draft maps.
Yeah.
We're looking at areas for potential redevelopment where that would meet the criteria.
Yeah,
we presented based on conversation with stakeholders, based on conversation with council. We presented a final draft map of, hey, here's what we could get up to, that 2.5% Kevin mentioned of our total city mass. Here's what it would look like. Here's a draft of it.
Yeah.
Now we have to go through the formal process.
They have to actually approve it by ordinance. They've taken a look at a draft map, which is what you're thinking of.
How did you do the stakeholders, get the input from the stakeholders?
So talked to several landowners in the area that were, it was mostly landowners in the areas that may have been impacted by it, that had, were primarily looking at developable land, vacant land, or anything like that. We don't want it to be, if you look at the goofy lines of the central business district, the reason it's like that is because we don't want it to be residential. There's not, I mean, somebody could do, I guess, hypothetically, do their home as a Gplot if they provided the economic incentive to the public for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which most residential units are not going to provide.
Right.
But hypothetically, if somebody turned a home into a revenue-generating thing, they could do a Gplot on. But we didn't really want to try to incentivize that in neighborhoods,
okay.
right? Residential yeah. neighborhoods. So we were looking at developable areas that were in need of development or in need of revitalization, anything like that. So vacant land is obviously very easy to increase by 100% in value with development or abandoned buildings, anything like that.
That's so why the map essentially looks like an octopus, because if you look at, you know, it stretches out along the major corridors for a reason.
Right.
We're trying to include, to the extent possible, you know, commercial and industrial properties that have redevelopment potential and avoid the neighborhoods to the extent possible. So you have my contact information, Mike's contact information. We give you a couple of handouts. I'll be happy to provide the presentation or any of this documentation in electronic form if you guys want to shoot me an email or give me a call, okay? So thank you all for your time. I appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Appreciate it. We just going to step out and see her. She's out here for a moment.
Okay.
Passing the baton. That's right, it'll fall and break.
Okay.
Did you get the that spreadsheet?
Actually, that was over the last calendar year.
Oh, wow.
We just the last year.
Yeah. Here's some extra goodies.
Oh, thank you.
I got that. Share it.
Rendezvous Urban.
Do I do this?
Yeah.
Since we don't have to, we're not voting on anything. It's just an update, informational.
Sure. You want to go out of order, James?
I can do that.
Yeah, you can go next, and then
we'll come back to the vacancies and secretary.
Sure.
You're doing that specifically.
She's on a telephone call. She'll be back.
Yeah, so we decide on our secretary, and we'll wait.
Okay.
Come back.
Okay. So thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to give you guys an update on where we are with the PAG Long Range Regional Transit Plan. I gave an update to this group a couple of meetings back, and I believe at that time I talked about the recommendations that make up the core of the plan. I'm going to go back over those recommendations today just for the benefit of anybody who wasn't here or just sort of refresh the memories of everybody. As a point of reference, you can go to pagregion.com/transit to find the draft plan there, as well as all of the documentation that was used in the open house meetings for this effort, and also a document called the Choices Report, which provides a lot of background on transit in the region and also gives a really good overview of why how transit works generally, why certain design paradigms make transit more effective, things of that nature. So I would encourage you to go and review those documents if you're curious about some of the decision-making process that we went through. A brief background on what we did do for public outreach. In October of 2018, we held a transit planning workshop and concurrently open houses. That was sort of an initial effort. Several people in this room, I believe, attended, where we talked about, again, some of those design paradigms that make transit work, and we looked at some of the choices that are necessary to be made before you sort of, before you would design a transit system. Probably the easiest one for reference is coverage versus frequency. With a fixed budget, you kind of have to make decisions about how much your system covers a region versus how frequent your buses come. Then in November and December of 2018, we did an initial public survey sort of to gauge people's interest in various topics. Again, some of that stuff is online if you'd like to look at it. In January 2019, we did a core design workshop. This was a technical effort. We brought together regional transit planners and actually did a lot of the network planning and service planning at that point. And then in August 2019, we brought the plan back with the results of that core design workshop for additional public feedback, and we did two more open houses at that time as well. And then most recently, we did a priority survey, and I'll talk about that at the end of this presentation. So I'm not going to get into the detail on that, but just to try to help us understand how the public felt about the recommendations and how those should be implemented. So I probably should have been on this slide when I was just doing the talking. This is some photos from all that I just said. So kind of the recommendations. I want to just make a quick note here that the plan outlines a medium term, which is a roughly 5 to 10 year time frame from, and I want to make a point here, this is 5 years from the point of receiving identified funding. Mm-hmm. Nothing in this plan has identified funding, and that will have to be, that's a very important point to make. This is not a planning document. It is not a programmatic document. So once funding is identified at that point and it's authorized, then it would be five to 10 years from that point for the medium term. Then the second scenario is a longer term. This would be a 10 to 20 year scenario. I'm focusing mostly on the medium term here at this point because it's probably the most feasible given the climate that we're in, funding climate that we're in. But again, the long term is all outlined in the draft plan if you'd like to go and look at that.
And I'm sorry, you said it, but so medium term is 5 to 10 years after funding is identified?
Correct.
And then longer term is 10 years, is there?
10 year to 20 is what we put, but okay. You know, really just any time.
Okay.
The funding associated with the longer term improvements is considerable, and so there would have to be a considerable public interest in funding that. It would be a pretty big lift from our current system. But we did want to put those options out there for decision makers to look at. So this is for the medium term scenario, expanding the frequent network. I'm going to go into all these in more detail. Improving service spans on weekends and evenings, targeted service improvements to suburban transit routes. This is supporting mostly the Sun Shuttle system that we currently have. And then infrastructure improvements involving speed, reliability, and service quality. These are to try to increase the reliability of the bus service and make it more competitive with car travel. First, expanding the frequent network. The map that you see here is the current frequent network. As many of you are aware, this is service that's 15 minutes or better, although I believe SunTrain defined it as 20 minutes or better on the network. Within a half mile of this current network, there are currently approximately 2,600 Pima County residents, and 50% of Pima County jobs are accessible within a half mile. The recommendation for expanding the network increases the access by 100,000 residents within a half mile of the proposed frequent network and increases the access to jobs by 9%. And I'll just flip back and forth here so you can kind of see the difference between the existing and the proposed. Again, we tried, during the design workshop, we tried to place a lot of emphasis on continuing the grid system into the southern part of the city. As any of you who are familiar with traveling in the southern part, the network down there is not very much of a grid pattern right now, which makes transfers kind of necessary a lot of times, and some of those commutes a little bit longer. Some of the analysis that we did to kind of qualify the improvements that we expect to see from the recommendations being implemented. This is a isochrone, and essentially it's just a fancy word for a travel time map. This is 45 minutes weekday at noon from the little red dot that you see there. That's the University of Arizona. University of Arizona on the left and Spectrum Mall on the right. The gray area is the existing 45-minute travel time on the existing network, and the light blue area is the expanded travel time after the implementation of the improvements. And you'll note that the improvements, again, reflecting the network design, are going to show up more in areas in the south because that's where a lot of that frequent network expansion is going to be implemented. This is another analysis. This is a job access map. Essentially, if you look at these individual hexagons, if you imagine yourself standing in the middle of that, the intensity of the red indicates how many jobs you would have access to in 45 minutes from that point. So this is the existing network on a weekday. This is the improvement based on the recommendation for the frequent network.
Is that downtown, the reddest part there?
Yeah, and that's downtown, and you can see, so this is the existing, the downtown would be in that central area, and that's just because of the density of the buses that come into the downtown area.
Yeah.
And then along, it's Broadway, I guess,
yeah.
The major one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Broadway is the one you can see that extends all the way out. Does extend up out. And then this is the expected improvement based on the recommendations.
And the hexagon is a quarter mile in diameter.
Well, again, it's not so much important that the hexagon, the expansion of the hexagon, it's more about how far you can get from the hexagon. So if you imagine, if you're standing in the middle of that hexagon, you can access, let's just say it's the 50,000 jobs from that point. It isn't 50,000 jobs inside that hexagon.
No, I understand that. I was just trying to think of the person standing there walking, you know, their relationship to them. Yeah. Never mind.
Probably not critical.
So the second recommendation, improving weekend service. This is the existing network on weekdays. The frequencies on the weekdays, obviously the red is the frequent network. Blue is anything lower than 15 minutes. This is the weekend, this is the Sunday network. And you'll notice that dramatic reduction in frequency on the weekends. Right now, Sunday service is approximately 35% of the current weekday service. The recommendations that we are, or that the plan proposes, would bring Saturdays and Sundays up to the same level of frequency as the weekdays. So you're talking about same frequency 7 days a week. You know, as we're very much aware, we're a 7 day a week culture these days and economy, and one of the fastest growing segments of that economy is service jobs, which often are 7 day a week type employment. Additionally, it's there's fairly good evidence to support that a person who works on the weekends is more likely to choose transit as their primary mode if they know that they can rely on transit 7 days a week. And that way they don't need to buy a car to get to work on Saturday or Sunday. Or to use a car to get to work on Saturday or Sunday. Evening service, very similar to the weekday service. Evening service falls off considerably after 7 p.m. This is the existing, again, the existing network, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. This is the after 7 p.m. network. Most routes are only hourly, and there's only a few that are 30 minutes. The recommendation we're making is to bring the at least the frequent network routes up to operating at every 30 minutes. So after 7 p.m. until midnight, the entire frequent network would operate at every 30 minute. I apologize, there's a little bit of clipping. I need to approve this image here, but this is the targeted suburban improvements. And again, these are mostly improvements to the outlying jurisdictions. Some of these are on SunTran routes, like the Route 16 extending out to Cortero, but a lot of these are extensions for the Sun Shuttle system itself. And those extensions include Cortero, as I mentioned, additional service up Oracle Road, more direct service to Drexel Heights and the Pasco Pueblo, frequent service to the airport, additional service to the Southeast employers and schools, and more frequent service to the San Javier District, Sarita and Green Valley. Infrastructure improvements. These are, again, as I mentioned earlier, mostly to support the expansion of the network and to make it more competitive with car travel and more attractive to users. This also includes bus purchases of new vehicles to support the expanded frequent network. To run at higher frequency, you need more vehicles, so you need additional vehicles to do that. We are recommending that all those vehicles be alt-fueled, although it's not, of course, a prescription, it's just a recommendation. We're also recommending transit priority at intersections. This can be things like queue jumps or transit signal priority. Additionally, buses, new benches, shelters, and lighting at all FTN stops. This is to increase the service quality for customers and just to, you know, overall increase the service levels and feelings of comfort at those stops. And then, of course, something that we've talked about in this group a lot, which is onboard technology to help people navigate the system more easily. Things like next bus arrival information, things that I believe SunTran is already working on, but perhaps doesn't have funding for, so we were recommending those as a definite upgrade to the current experience. These improvements are recommended to essentially expand with the network, so as the FTN is implemented, these improvements would follow suit to sort of, you know, over a course of that 10 years to follow that network expansion. Some of these, like some of the infrastructure improvements at intersections, might take a little longer. They might need to wait until roads were being reconstructed. For some of them, transit signal priority could be implemented without much infrastructure change there, so that could probably happen a little sooner. Okay, so jumping to the priority survey, This was the last survey that we conducted, and again, it was primarily to help us ask the public for feedback on how we should implement these recommendations and how we should stage those. The first question we asked was to rank the importance of the following items from 1 to 6 in order of importance to the survey respondent. What we heard is there wasn't a lot of room between these. Everyone thought they were relatively important, although there were a few clear winners. Obviously, the frequent transit network came out on top with weekend and evening following closely. What we actually recommended, what we're actually going to be recommending in the plan, is that weekend and evening be implemented prior to FTN, and this is really just a matter of logistics. Since FTN weekend and evening sort of came out on top, FTN expansion is going to require, as I mentioned, purchasing new vehicles, which will take time. Even if you bought new vehicles today, it could take up to 18 months for those vehicles to be delivered. Whereas weekend and evening service could essentially be implemented right out of the gate, assuming funding is found. So if you see in the final plan, the recommendation is to approve the weekend and evening first and then FTN following as soon as those vehicles are made available. The second part of the survey was asking people about the proportion of the recommendation. So essentially, are we proposing the right amount of these different recommendations? And what we got back from the public was, yes, they felt that we were proposing the right amounts. On most of these, the only one that sort of stuck out was the frequent network, where you can see that at least 30% of respondents thought that we should be recommending more. So where are we in the timeline? At this point, we are concluding the 30-day public review and comment period, and our goal is to take the final draft plan to the PAG Mayor and Council, the PAG Regional Council, at the end of this month on the 30th. That's also going to be a official public hearing for the plan as well. So the January 30th meeting of the PAG Regional Council will be hopefully final approval for the plan. Questions?
Hey, this ain't the thing that Jared Walker helped you with, is it?
This is, yes.
Oh, this is the thing?
Yes, they were the consultant. Jared Walker and Associates was the consultant team.
So it last time the RTA said 27% was supposed to be for transit?
Correct.
A, is that really what has happened? And B, like, all this stuff sounds really good, but how much more than 27% would you?
Going to depend on how much. Let me answer the first question.
Yeah.
Yes, 27% is what we've kept it at.
Is that really happening?
Yes.
Think? Okay.
Yes. So what we've essentially what
so, I'm been, sorry, 27% you're keeping out.
So let me back up. So the RTA plan was roughly $1.9 billion. Yeah. It was 2.1, but some of it had to be kept back for various administrative costs. So $1.9 billion of actual project costs. Although that number, we have not really reached that number because of the economic recession. So we didn't pull in, we're not forecasting that we're actually going to pull in the full $1.9 billion. However, we've still kept the 27% of whatever we're taking for transit. So although we're not taking in the full amount that we thought we were, we're still keeping the 27%. So I've essentially, whenever I make the budget, and when I work with the City of Tucson to make the budget, we get the 27% of whatever we've forecasted we're going to take as the budget number.
It's under the existing RTA.
Correct.
Mandate or whatever.
But for the next plan, that's not been established.
No. No. That process is being undertaken right now with the Citizens Advisory Committee. So they're just getting that started. There's a meeting next week, in fact, where I'm going to be presenting this same information to that group. And that group will ultimately be the ones who make the decision about what composition transit makes up in the RTA continuation.
Do they make it up, or do they just hand it to the RTA, which is South Tucson, Marana?
So the project recommendations are all going to come from the jurisdictions.
Okay.
So they get to sort of set the table on what the projects are going to be that are going to be discussed. And the CAC and ultimately the regional council, I'm sorry, the RTA board is the ultimate decision maker
Just making sure.
Yeah. And the RTA board is, of course, composed of all of the leaders.
Yeah, yeah.
All the mayors.
Right.
So following up a little on Brian's thing then, so the
The projects will come from the individual jurisdictions, like you said. So it's up to them to, you know, figure out what they want to do. And I lost my train of thought where I was going to go with that. So let me hit another thing.
But Gene, you know, that thing said only 14% on the survey was for suburban improvements. Everybody's suburban out of all those. I mean, you know, when you look at the RTA, the only urban ones are Tucson,
South Tucson,
and kind of Pima County. You know what I mean? Pima County goes both ways. So that's problematic. If you've got a bunch of votes that are going to vote suburban instead of urban.
That depends on who answered their survey.
Yeah, and again, you know, what I want to make the emphasis here is this plan and any of the contents in the plan are not the RTA plan. They are not. Okay, so this is just a planning tool that the decision makers, the jurisdictions who bring the projects to the CAC and the CAC themselves can use. We intentionally sort of set it up as a a la carte, if you will, menu of items that they can pull from to ultimately make the project selections that they want to. So nothing on this plan ties anyone's hands whatsoever.
So you assumed in the future, if RTA is reauthorized, that it would be the same 27%. So have you put cost to any of these?
Right.
Or are these
so
just good. The things you want to accomplish
at
this
point? These are the things we do have costs associated with all this, but they are very much the things that we, based on the needs surveys, the current needs assessment, and the initial workshops, public hearing, or public feedback survey, and outreach to the public, things that we thought would be necessary to sort of bring the transit system up to a higher level of functionality.
Right, and these can be done, assuming a 20-year period again, loaded low loading at the first 10 years, a higher loading at the second 10, that these could be done within what would be raised, projected to be raised by a reauthorized RTA.
No. We did not constrain our recommendations to
so
what the RTA.
So if we're held to 27% when the RTA gets hold of it, then you might only get a small portion of this, or if they reduce it, you'd get less than that.
That's correct.
You'd get, you might only get barely enough to continue the improvements that were made with the RTA, the previous RTA. On the other hand, if it went the other way and the community was really convinced about the need for better transit, instead of getting 27%, we might get 33 or more.
40?
Not likely 40, but, you know.
You can dream.
No, you're absolutely
right. Showing pictures of Australia on fire, right. That's how we get 40%.
The future is wide open in terms of what that could look like. It's going to be entirely up to the decision-making process that's going to happen.
So it's a typical long-range plan that you project out there what you'd like to see, but it never happens because there's never enough funding.
Got to go find the funding.
You got to go find
it. If you don't plan for it, it'll never happen.
Alex has something.
How many people were in the survey? How many people responded to
this? The initial survey was around 2,500. The second survey was 850.
And do you know demographics of, like, who was responding?
Yes. We did ask demographic information, and we do have that breakdown available if you're interested. What we tried to do was also track where the responses. We used SurveyMonkey for a lot of it. We made paper surveys available if people wanted to, but we didn't get a lot of takers on that. We did make the information available in Spanish and English. But we tried to track by zip code, mm-hmm. and if we saw that there was a certain zip code where we weren't getting a lot of responses, what we did is we sent out on-the-ground survey takers to go to those places that would likely be people who are using transit, like transit centers. We went to a couple of school campuses and try to collect surveys that way. So we did try to focus and make sure that we were getting a broad brush sample, and we didn't just sort of throw it out there and hope for the best.
You know those things that are referred to as bus pullouts, mm-hmm. but done by the RTA? But really they're car pullouts. They're for the benefit of cars. Is that anywhere in here? Like, is it hidden in, you know what I mean?
We didn't recommend any bus pullouts.
You're not gonna do any more?
I can't say that they won't be part of the plan, but they weren't in this plan.
Okay. How do we keep those? Those should be charged to the road monies, not to the bus monies.
That's a different discussion.
So it's not in here at all?
Well, that's probably an RTA.
Yeah.
When you compile the RTA, you want to have a funding of what's the money going to be used for, and that would be a good point.
That'd
to bring
be
up under that.
So to your question, the bus pullouts were not part of the transit element. Yeah.
They're counterpart of the safety element, is what they call them.
Correct. Yeah, they were not part of the 27% of the transit funding.
They were. Where were they?
They were in the safety.
They were a different category.
Jay, can you talk about the high capacity transit piece that's in here?
So yeah.
Reading through, I just see that it says that the study, most recent study, was from 2017, was part of it's an appendix to this.
Correct.
So I didn't realize that, so I didn't go look at it, but I see that there are.
Well, it's also not online at this point yet.
Okay.
So it will be made part of the final document.
Okay. So there's five or six routes that were looked at. Are these ranked in any way, or does the appendix rank them, or kind of where
no,
does that
sit? No, so essentially what we did in that study, we worked with HTR on that, is we went out and looked at the feasibility of transit corridors for high capacity. And if you read through the plan, you'll see we did a number of different sort of phasings where we identified likely corridors and then eliminated ones that didn't seem less likely. So what we came up with were essentially six recommended corridors, and again, it's a planning document. It doesn't hold anyone to account for anything. It's not, but it just identified technical reasons why we believe these corridors are feasible. When we reached the end of that, when we sort of got to the point where we were saying, well, at some point we should make a recommendation, right? What we kind of came to the conclusion of is that it wasn't really our purview to make a recommendation based on a technical study alone. And essentially what we determined was that there were some factors that would need to go into play for the region to make a huge investment in another high capacity transit system. Some of those things include, what are we trying to achieve? Are we trying to move people, or are we trying to make a place? If we're trying to move people, then it probably would lend itself toward one particular type of mode in a certain configuration. If we're trying to make a place, it might lend itself toward another mode, like a streetcar, like the downtown area. So what are we trying to achieve? We couldn't answer that question without the public's feedback. And honestly, the other part of that question is really, if you're going to invest that much money into a high-capacity system, high-capacity transit, by definition, needs to move a lot of people, and you're not going to get a lot of people without some density. So if you're going to put high-capacity transit somewhere, it almost sort of pre-assumes that that area is going to be a dense environment. So we need to make a decision as a community, where do we want our continued dense environment to go? Do we want it north, south, east, etc.? Probably not west, mountains. But that conversation needs to be had. Those analyses need to happen, and we didn't feel like we were in the position to do that. So essentially we stopped the study at looking at the existing corridors and saying, here's six that are feasible. And the next phase, undertaken by maybe another group at a different time, could dive a little deeper and determine, if we need it, and if we do, where should it go?
And who ultimately decides that? The RT?
So I was going to ask Diana?
Yes.
For the high capacity transit, so there's kind of a few on the table, but they're not ranked, and I know that the FTEA grant is looking at one, but that doesn't necessarily lock in that that's the next one or the first one. Will the mobility master plan rank or prioritize high capacity transit routes, or kind of what's the, do we know what the process
is? That is the intent.
Okay, that'll be where that happens then. Okay, thank you.
When is the next meeting of the mobility master plan?
Well, can I jump in?
You can.
Perfect.
Hey, I have one more question on the survey thing. Like, did people talk about security and safety in there?
No, because that we determined that was, those kind of things tend to fall more into the operational realm and not into the network design realm. So that's sort of like not long term. It's sort of a short term consideration for operations,
okay,
like SunTran operations, to make those decisions, not planners who are thinking about network design.
Did the thing have a place where you do that 1 through 6 and stuff, and then make comments?
We did have comment areas on, I believe, on all the surveys, and we did get some comments back.
Can you comment on that?
Yeah, no, I mean, a lot of them tended to be more like kind of high-level stuff. We did get some comments about sort of operational questions, but again, that's sort of outside the purview of what we were trying to document here. So on the higher-level comments, a lot of them, you know, talked about energy use and, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
So stuff that, you know.
So on the Mobility Master Plan, actually, what I have here, and I'd like to pass that real quick to y'all, is an invitation. We're doing the public kickoff meeting on February the 5th at 5 o'clock, I want to say, but I'm going to 5:30 to 7:30. It'll be held at the TEP building. The mayor will actually be our initial MC kind of hosting, and then we actually have Gabe Klein, who is a national speaker. On rebuilding cities from car-centric to multimodal, and he has a great background with that. So we're going to be doing that kickoff meeting, and I'd like to personally extend an invitation for each one of y'all to participate. We'd love to have you there. This is going to be a fun night. It's a social night, but it's a chance for us to start talking about the Mobility Master Plan, and from that point we'll actually be able to provide a timeline and everything we're moving forward. So the Mobility Master Plan's initial kickoff is actually, again, is beginning on February the 5th at 5:30 at the TEP building. Here is an invitation.
Thank you.
And I would love to see y'all there. And then we will be having a lot more dialogue as we move forward.
Do you have a target audience for who you want there, type of thing?
Well, we're hoping to get around 200 people to be participating in this opening. So it's mainly going out to all of our advisory board members, as well as it's also going out to the presidents of the civic associations, the neighborhood association, and the homeowners associations, business leaders, chambers, those type of folks. So we're really trying to get as many folks that we need to participate that can also help us with the network, because again, the Mobility Master Plan, which is actually being referred to as Move Tucson, is really about building that balanced transportation system. And we really want to know all of those different networks that we can have a chance to meet with and have the conversation as a whole. So it's also open to the public. We'll be doing some public announcement, but we want to make sure that we're personally extending an invitation to all of the advisory board members, because it's really important that we have you there as we begin this conversation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Does a lot of this have to do with, like, should there be a streetcar versus bus rapid transit?
That's part of the conversation. That's part of the conversation. It's one that we'll have as we go through. Again, there's a balance. We already have one loop, so it does make sense to extend it. But I don't feel the streetcar is the answer to everything. I think you have to be very strategic with your streetcars or your light rail systems, and then your transit, again, is a complement. Your car should be a complement on top of that after you add in your bus and your pedestrian modes first. So I think it's one part of it. And again, so when I reference the Mobility Master Plan, which now we're calling Move Tucson, when we talk about Move Tucson, it's about building a balanced transportation system, which requires all of the elements to be part of the equation, not one element. So I think the streetcar plays a very important role, but it's not the only thing that plays a role. I think transit plays a very important role, and I think we need to figure out how that's gonna look and feel and how everything's gonna support each other. We have to have all of those elements if we're gonna be successful in the future with the transportation system. If we want to rely strictly on just transit, we will fail, just like we failed with the cars. Can't rely on just one transportation element. You have to have a balance among all of them, and that's something I want the community to tell me what they feel that balance is. That's the reason why we're working so hard on this outreach, to try to make sure we can hear from the community as a whole and then find out what that balance is and what those compromises need to be and how to best prioritize the uses so that we can move it forward. Because the reality is also, you can't have every mode. You have to balance your modes. Does that help? Kind of vague, but there.
But you know, in terms of Move Tucson, even Mayor Rothschild agreed with me all the time that it was about, that the streetcar was about economic development. That would be a neutral term, as opposed to moving Tucson. You know what I mean?
So, I agree with you. I'm going to agree with you on that, because you have a 4-mile loop. And a four-mile loop is only touching one set of businesses, opportunities for economic development. If you extend that loop where it starts touching out to other areas and you be very strategic in it, then you have a better network that supports it. So yes, I agree with you. Typically when you're doing a streetcar, that first loop that goes in is all economic development, economic development, economic development. How you build off of that first loop is where you need to be strategic on how you're moving people. But if you do nothing, it's only going to be an economic development, but it shouldn't be just one loop.
Okay.
It should be an extension, but we should be very strategic, and it shouldn't be our only answer.
Okay.
It should not be the only answer to how we're building a mass transportation system.
Can I ask one more question? Jared Walker was really clear when he was here that that the streetcar's not fast enough to like go into a bigger, farther, longer solution to moving Tucson. So is that in your mind or in the mind of your department and the elected people, even the RTA? Like, you guys agree with Jared Walker on that? Suzanne, that's correct, isn't it? You heard Jared Walker.
Well, just as currently configured in traffic, it's a slow,
yeah,
slow move.
Because right now it is a streetcar and it moves in the, with the traffic.
Yeah.
Right. But to me, as we think about the extension of the streetcar and adding different systems to the streetcar so that it touches, we might want to look at light rail. And light rail will move much faster
like
than
Phoenix.
Yes. And there makes some sense of where you can take a light rail system and tie it into a streetcar. And again, that's a conversation as a community we need to have. Again, not one element wins.
Yeah, okay.
So
the other thing I would say, Brian, is, and I think a lot of cities have gotten into a, because of the way San Diego did the first street, the first light rail line that became a revival of light rail in this country, they've gotten into that mode that the almost the entire line has to be fast. And I don't think that's necessarily the case. In fact, if you go to San Diego, the first 2 miles are on downtown streets, mm-hmm. and it runs slow. And if you go to San Francisco, which retained their light rail system out of the old streetcar system, it runs fast in downtown because it's in a subway. And then it branches out into five branches out in the residential areas. And to me, that they're both good models. And which one you choose depends on your situation and what you want to accomplish. But I think a lot of cities have overlooked this, what I call the San Francisco model, which is also the Pittsburgh model, where from downtown they're in a tunnel, they go through under the streets, and then they go across an exclusive bridge, and then they go through a tunnel under the hills, and then they branch out into the neighborhoods. And I love that kind of option myself. I think it's a much preferable option, but nobody's doing it. I don't know why. But anyway, that's
cost is it, you know, but again, I don't think it's the only solution. I think there's multiple solutions, and we need to look at all of them and see how each one of the different transportation modes complement each other.
And then it's about cost, right?
It's always about cost. But there's opportunities to partner from the private sector side as well from the federal government to move all those initiatives forward. But that's part of the TOD grant that we applied for, was to look at it. We're looking at that as a BRT and a potential light rail system. So, you know, mixing both or having it be one or the other, you know, or be both. So that's part of the feasibility study we want to look at.
Is BRT way cheaper?
So BRT is way cheaper. The federal government is now actually starting to provide you some funding. It depends on what you're calling a BRT. So there's different types of BRT. If we want to talk about a true BRT, a true BRT is typically built into a highway system, and it actually operates in its own lane. It has its own connections. It has its own way. A BRT is going to operate, if you call it a BRT, but it's on a local street, like in our downtown, it's going to run like a streetcar.
Unless it's had its own dedicated right-of-way.
It is cheaper because you're not putting rails in the ground.
Yeah.
However, you don't get the economic, as strong of an economic development side on that. There have been some successes out there with BRTs where people have done the type of infrastructure improvements that BRTs are in place for 25 years, and they've seen some of that economic development come in. So again, it goes back to, what as a community do we want? where those BRTs that we want to put them. Like, ideally, I think Broadway is going to be a great example down the road for us to consider looking at that and creating a BRT down Broadway. And I think there'll be some opportunities there to have that conversation. You know, and I think there we could actually look at doing that, building it, making it also more permanent to allow for that economic development, which is really the corridor we want some economic development to happen on.
What about 6th South?
Yes. I think we have to look at that because, again, and that's going to be part of that TOD feasibility study if we're successful with getting from the federal government. So, because that connection to the airport is key. Is very key. And our ridership to the airport and to downtown right now through transit is not great. No. So we really do need to look at those opportunities. Sorry. Thank y'all for giving me a few minutes on the invitation.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much, James. Appreciate it. And we'll see where it goes from here. Find some money for that plan. next agenda item, so we're going to back up to number 6 for the vacancies and the secretary position that is open. So let's just jump straight to the vacancies. I know you already have some names. You're presenting, collecting more names, and we'll present that.
Right. And then there's a miss. I should say 3 vacancies to be forwarded on. Obviously, Ward 4, that's up to Councilmember Lee.
Okay.
But, we're putting together a list that I will give to Director Alarcon, who will ultimately decide who she would like to keep on that list and forward to the city manager for consideration. We have 2 folks who are on the list currently, but if you all have any other names you want to throw in the hat, Gene's one of them, and I won't mention the other person's name for privacy concerns, but they have formally applied. So, you know, anyone who's interested, let me know. You can email me or tell me.
Did they apply through city manager?
City manager.
What's that?
Did they apply through city manager or through Ward 4?
This is going to be the city manager. So we're going to present a list of candidates through our office to the city manager's office.
That's a typical way.
Yeah. You're all staff.
Yeah. And Ward 4, that's up to them.
That's Ward 4.
Yeah. So.
And then, for secretary, do you want to share about kind of where we're at on that?
Yeah, so it was on the agenda last month, and we asked for self-nomination or otherwise, and no one was self-nominated or nominated anyone. So Eric moved to have it be agendized this month, and one solution we found is to reduce the detail in the written minutes, which is less burdensome to both staff and potentially secretary, and basically eliminates the need for a secretary. And then rather than having extensive written minutes, there's an audio file available on the TTF website, on the clerk's webpage, rather. I can also put it on the TTF website. So that's a solution that is kosher, so to speak, with open meeting law. The clerk okayed it, and that way we're freed up, you all are freed up, and it seems like a healthy compromise.
Eric, first.
Okay. I move we accept the recommendation of staff and go to an audio recording.
Alex, you had a comment?
Yeah, has anyone checked the quality of said audio? Like, could you actually be able to hear public comment from the different parts of the room on the audio file?
You can hear it, yeah. You'll have to turn your speakers up sometimes, but hear it.
That's a note. That's something that we can do, is to invite any calls to the audience to maybe, you know, come stand closer to the table to share. So that's something maybe we can do to help that.
Yeah, it does a pretty good job of capturing everyone's comments.
My question is why this committee is being asked to do that. All the other committees I serve on, staff take the minutes, and there doesn't seem to be a problem.
Actually, the bicycle and the pedestrian both, they have a citizen part of the committee that is the secretary and does their minutes, yeah. So we're the only
transportation one that doesn't do our own minutes. So
I still think you should get some of the staff that's here to do it.
Well, actually, I should mention we've reduced our staff footprint here at the meeting per your request, Brian. Okay. You'll notice that.
Yeah, I did notice.
There's no entourage, right?
Yeah, right. I did notice that.
Yeah, Rhett Crowninshield, the administrator, would normally be here, but he's at a conference. Yeah. So
you're stuck with me today.
So we have a motion on the table to accept the reduced typed minutes, but to have the audio version publicly available. Any more comments or questions on that, or is there a second? Yeah, is there a second for that?
It's the only reason we're doing this because no one stepped up to be secretary.
So we're reducing the amount of staff support to be in line with the other TDOT committees.
Oh, but I mean, like, no.
But within the group, correct?
Yeah,
no one. Correct.
No one has decided to take on being secretary. So our alternative is then to do an audio.
There still have to be written minutes, but they're very abbreviated, like last month, so they don't really offer those details that some might want. But then the audio recording is the substitute for that.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, a friendly amendment is would it be possible, or is it? I'm thinking of things like this that are provided after meeting, if these can be scanned or requested digitally from folks who present to be included with the minutes as well that are posted, so that this kind of data is in there as well.
Yes.
Okay. Just so that folks get a full picture of that.
Anything that's passed out that's not provided prior in the minute with the board package, we will actually add to the minutes.
Okay. And then I would say then for members here, that if you have input or comments that you particularly want to have in writing or something documented, then it's our obligation as members to provide that in writing to Chris to include with the minutes. Otherwise it's on the audio. But if you say, you know, this is what I want, or I'm bringing some notes, or here's some research that I found, if you want that included in the minutes, then it's up to us individually to bring those and provide those.
Could we possibly revisit the efficacy of this new system in like a couple months? Like after we've seen it get posted? Because
yeah.
I would like to listen to the audio and like try to use it, you know, and use the new system and see if it's useful or if it, I would just, yeah.
That's good.
I'm all for that. I mean, I'm about continual improvement. You know, this is really, it's very time consuming, and we do have limited staff. So I appreciate the comment about why the entourage, because I was wondering the same thing myself. So it's very time consuming to do that detail of amendment. So follow Robert's rules here, which is what we're asking to do, where you'll still have the minutes, but then the audio will give you the details. We certainly, after, you know, 3 months, can come back and visit, and if there's concerns, we can look at addressing them, and if we can't address them, then we can have a further conversation.
Okay.
So then the amendment is to accept this and then revisit in 3 months, and we can just agendize it in 3 months?
Yeah, well, there's no actual recommendation for a motion.
Okay.
So I'll need you to make a motion.
So Eric made a motion. To go to the basic outline minutes, like what you presented, with an audio file that's posted and available for the public.
So legal action.
Backup materials that may be distributed during the meeting.
Yes. But do you want to make it so that you want to make sure it works good? You want to listen to it first?
And then we'll revisit in 3 months to see if that's functioning as intended. Okay. So that's the motion. Is there a second for that?
Yeah. Second.
All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Okay. So we have one, Margo. Okay, so we'll do it for 3 months, revisit, and see where we're at. Okay. Next agenda item is the budget.
time.
10 minutes.
Yep.
Well, there's not much to say because it's just the timeline. We're developing the budget currently, and the timeline is what was requested at the last meeting, and that's what we're able to provide. But as far as details of the budget, that's still being developed. So.
So looking at this, then when would we see something?
I think in February we will have a draft budget that we'll be able to bring forward to y'all.
Okay.
And then be, and also for discussion and comments, and then we would be able to make take those comments and discussion back and see what we can do about addressing that.
Okay.
How are you? Can you say how you're feeling personally, or are you optimistic, or how's transit looking in your mind? Especially with the new bosses, or can you say that?
I'll have a better outcome for you. We're actually doing a retreat with them on January the 28th.
Well, that's later than usual.
Yeah, so I'm really looking, so we have had, so I've been before council already in a discussion with them in reference to the HERF dollars. I've been in discussion with them, and I'm going to be before them on Park Tucson. The next meeting on the 28th, I'll actually be talking with them in reference to transit. So we'll be diving into that at the retreat on the 28th. So I'll have a much better idea about what they're thinking, what they're asking me to do, what they're looking for us to do. Right now I have staff doing some major looks. We're having some conversations looking at where there's opportunities and efficiencies, where we might be able to take some dollars from one place and move it to another that would help us actually improve the overall operations and the routes and the service level that we're providing. So we are looking at that. Some of that includes looking at if there's opportunities to, instead of having a full-size bus, going down to a cutaway bus that is actually more efficient but provides the same level of service, but it might offer us more dollars to actually extend that time, right, so that we can offer better services and maybe pick up ridership. So we're doing a lot of that digging in right now, and we're trying to get that all done and narrowed so we can have some of that conversation with y'all and with the council so that we know what direction they want us to move.
What should we do as, like, the public advocating for transit right now? Wait for you for the next meeting?
Or? So it's always important to make sure that they maintain the current budget we have, because if we were to have that cut, that would be very detrimental to the overall route operations. So
yeah,
that's very helpful right there.
Okay.
And anytime we can get dollars added, of course, that's better, because, you know, we have some challenges right now. You know, SunGo is a big challenge. That's a really, you know, that is not working sufficiently and not well. We actually probably need to replace it.
Huh.
The cost to do that is astronomical.
Huh.
And so that requires us looking at, so when I say I'm looking for efficiencies, to me, if we were able to offer a more seamless operation to the consumer, whether it's through your smartphone or whether it's on a kiosk or something, that's going to help as well. That's good, but I don't have the dollars to be able to go after that. And then I think also y'all put together a subcommittee to take a look at some of the, correct? Did we do that?
Yes.
Did we?
I was calling it a focus
we did.
Group. Mistakenly, but it's a subcommittee.
I'm indifferent. I just want some help because SunGo is a challenge. And
yeah,
as we've been digging into it and I've been learning more about it, they're not interested in being a good service provider. So to me, when I don't have someone who's going to try to help us to help our customers have a better level of service, I want to look at moving on. To move on is very expensive. To stay with them is very expensive. So I want to be able to weigh what is the better option, and that's where I was asking for help from y'all as far as giving us some direction on what you think. That's something we need done sooner than later, because I'd like to build all that into the budget. So part of finding some efficiencies within the operations today is finding those dollars to be able to fix that, because I feel like if we fix that element, we're going to be able to kind of start continue to push us forward and forward and forward, which is really where we need to be going.
Eric, yes.
Diana, when you can talk to us in this committee about that, can you also give us like dream sheet request? You know, we want to, if we were going to add extra routes, we get a 5% increase next year, or 10 or 20.
So I would tell you realistically, I would not look at getting any additional budget dollars. We're not really looking at right now of having any higher tax dollars come in. That's going to, in the general fund, that's going to give us opportunities to raise our dollars, because you got to remember we're supported through the general fund for transit. So I'm looking at where are those opportunities within our current budget our operations? Where can we get streamlined? Where can we get efficient? Where is it that we can have those improvements so we can take those dollars and still use them within transit, but use them to allow us to move our initiatives forward,
okay,
to extend those hours, add better ridership, create a better feel, add the better technology so that we're, I mean, we, you know, between, you know, RP Dev and the city, we all have some really great ideas, but everything takes money. Yeah. So we're just trying to figure out where we have some efficiencies that we might be able to use some of the money that's already in our pocketbook and use it to get us forward.
Can we have a conversation down the road about a dedicated funding source that frees us up from the general fund?
We can always have a conversation about a dedicated funding source.
Okay. We'll come knocking. We'll do that.
You know, that good thing about efficiencies and all that, how many years, Gene, have we sat here and dealt with that? So, I mean, it's like we've been efficient till we're blue in the face already. Yeah. It's kind of,
you're right. At some point, you run out of reasonable ways to be efficient.
Right. Oh, yeah, and that's when you're like, this is unreasonable. So that's when you start having another conversation with the community. If you want good transit, then we need to come up with a dedicated funding source to have good transit. I still think there is a few opportunities for us to have efficiencies and bring that back and have that conversation with y'all. But I think we are pretty close to where we are at that tap where we need to say, if we're going to really create a good, we're going to have to look at what those other cities have done to become a great transit city. And most of the time when you look at it, it's because they do have and created a dedicated funding source.
One other thing, in your experience now, is there any council offices that are particularly visionary or thinking about the dedicated funding source for transit, maybe?
I think they're all thinking about it. And I think right now what they're all really looking to is the Mobility Master Plan, Move Tucson, because that's looking at a mass transportation system that's gonna include all modes. So when they're thinking of it, they're thinking of it holistically, which is really the right way to be thinking about it. And so we're working toward that, of having that actually pulled together. We have a short timeline to do that, but it is our hopes that we will actually be having that conversation over the next 4 to 5 months. We want to make sure that we have that pulled together and projects prioritized for that transit initiative, for those initiatives as part of the RTA. And that may be our dedicated funding sources, the RTA. So we need to be including all of that. So that's why we're making this really hard push to get it all together. We need all of the community support so we know what that looks and feels like, so we can pull that together and give it to the RTA for the next RTA consideration.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Next call to the audience.
Yeah, I didn't know I was coming in. The Sunco system partly doesn't work because we don't have security to enforce collecting the fares. We cannot collect fares if they don't want to pay. Let them go. But as a result of that, the assaults are down on our drive. That, with the participants, has greatly helped. Okay? So either we have a free system or we don't. Either they pay or they don't. They ride or they don't. There is no... We were at one point a few years back where we were almost 100% collection of fares. When the Sunco system came into play and we did everything we were supposed to do, it worked. But then the assaults went up, the security went down, and everything just changed. Security helped us to do our job, which is collect the money, give them the ride, a safe ride. I don't got Uncle Bert back there anymore because I called and I got somebody to get him off the bus. But now I have to take Uncle Burby because there's nobody there. Who's going to come get me? Security is an underlying issue. Everybody goes around it. Let's not put any more money on security. Just never mind. Do you know how many bus stops out there have no lights? Zero lights.
Yes, lots.
There's a lot of them. But yet I keep hearing that all bus stops are supposed to have lights. They don't.
That's not even close.
You're standing there in the dark.
Well, I think that that's a challenge with our ordinance. So I think that's where we have because in 2012, there was an ordinance with the city that was passed about being a dark sky city, which only allowed for so much illumination, and some folks took that into consideration.
not to say I agree or disagree. I'm just saying there's different ways that people perceive that. And I think that that's probably a good conversation to be having as we move forward. We're going to do some type of lighting, we have to do it where it actually falls in and meets the requirements of our 2012 dark sky ordinance. And a lot of the light illumination that comes, they look at it as pollution, not as a support. I'm all about safety too, so I'm not saying I don't disagree with you.
Ida Road, no lights.
We have a lot of areas in the city where we have no light, even no street lights, much less pedestrian lights, which are very dark. Yeah.
Okay. But it's the security, like at Ronstadt, at Tono Center, Laos Center, it lacks. Even in those areas. And the main corridors, if you have a problem with that,
they have lights.
They're not about the lights, security.
It's the people, the security
on the main corridors. If I get out to Broadway and Loma, what do I have?
So you know what? I think that's a conversation you need to have with us, sidebar. That's an operational discussion.
This is something I've been bringing up for a long time.
Okay.
And I keep bringing it up.
So
because you're talking budget, this is budget. There needs to be more in the budget for security.
So again, this is an operational discussion, so we can actually set up a meeting with PD Dev in the city and we can have a bigger discussion. But that's something operational, not necessarily tied. But we'll make sure that we bring this discussion to the Transit Task Force for consideration. I'll share with you the same thing I share with my staff. I tell them to put everything they want in the kitchen sink on the table, and then we are going to prioritize what the needs are, and then that's what we're going to have to recommend. The reality is there is not enough money to do everything that we would like to do. So we're going to have to, and one of the things that we'll ask the task force is, here's a list of everything we would like to do. Here's your budget. What is it you want us to make sure you include? What is your recommendation that we include? Security may be it. Something else may be it. We'll make sure it's all on the table. It's a big issue, I can tell you, to Steve, because I'm having meetings with him every week, and that's all I'm hearing is security. So it's not going on deaf ears, just to let you know, because he's sharing it with me, and we're having that conversation now.
Looking out for him.
Yeah. And it's trying to figure out what we can get done with the budget that's available.
We need to enlarge that budget.
You go figure out how to get that done.
I know how I can help. That's what it's all about.
Suzanne, call the audience. Suzanne, yes.
One of the reasons that Kansas City Council finally voted to eliminate transit fares is because 90% of the altercations between passengers and drivers are in relation to fares. As we look at fare collection systems, which are exorbitantly expensive, I think we need to think about cost benefit. And I also just want to raise something that I used to raise repeatedly when I was on this committee, which is that the cost of collecting fares, the overall operational cost of collecting fares, should be a line item that's clear and available to the public. Because when we talk about fare box recovery ratio, we say we're getting 10 or 15 or 20 or whatever percentage of our operational cost from fares, we do not really know what that number is, because we are not subtracting the cost of collecting the fares. And if we don't know the cost of collecting the fares, we don't know what our fare box recovery is, we don't know what the cost of all of that security concerns are. I also wonder, in this whole discussion of the SunGo, my recollection is that the whole system was put in place with RTA money, and so how does that relate to the city talking about being responsible for coming up with a new system and paying for it? Anyway, all that's just kind of what's on my mind. SunGo,
good focus group discussion.
Thank you.
Claudia Cardinale, the Central Minister. When that new fare box came into effect on June 30th, the SERP came, still have a little blood at home for it. This system has always been an old system. It was never modern, it was never up to date. I miss the old system. I miss being able to hit number six and give them a day pass with paper, not the paper that you got when we put the new system in, but we had paper that was And we didn't charge these people to go find a card. They could get a day pass. They could get a transfer. They don't have to go get a credit card. It would be nice. I say, why do we have to be modern when we're not able to put the thing in to swipe my card with the app? Why can't we go backwards and have a system that we actually can give people what they need? No, you have to go to Fry's, you have to go downtown, you have to go to the kiosk and get a card. Why can't we just help our people to get what they need, to get a day pass, not to have to load their card before they left the house? And it won't work. I'm just saying, let's go backwards, not go forward, because we're not modern. The app doesn't work. It doesn't work with them. We don't have as Misty said, we don't have the things to read the app. Why do we need it?
Any other calls to the audience?
Thank you. Perfect.
You got one.
Yeah, I just wanted to introduce myself. My name is Antonio Ramirez. I'm with the Ward 1 office, our new communications director for LA and Santa Cruz. And I'm taking the lead on transportation.
Cool.
Thanks for joining
Welcome.
Us. We appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Antonio.
Okay, next meeting is February 3rd. Future agenda items is we'll have some budget stuff.
Good.
I assume we'll probably talk about vacancies and potential filling of those. Any other agenda items you'd like forward to Chris?
We are going
to have
specifics on the subcommittee.
Hey, yeah. The budget, bro. We want to hear about the budget.
Are you available?
I've got
meeting adjourned.
Yeah.
Crystal.
Yeah.
Thank you all. Also, when Laura sends out the quorum check, please respond so that we know whether it's worth coming down. So that if folks aren't going to make it, we don't have to.
I can tell you Lisa will not be here the next 2 months.
Okay. Good to know. So if you can't make it the next two meetings, be sure to let us know because we will not make quorum. So make it. How's that? I don't know.